Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. The University of Alaska Fairbanks' Rasmussen Library turns 50. Over the years, it's seen good times and bad.
It was sudden, and the reductions were implemented very quickly. We only had like an hour or so to notify staff that their names were on the list. And some people were traveling. We had to say, hey, Hank, I have some bad news.
Former director Paul McCarthy discusses his long career at the Rasmussen, and the current director, Karen Jensen, says COVID-19 has dampened but not extinguished her cruise passion.
It's been really hard seeing it just so quiet. But we are still providing those services. We're doing interlibrary loan. So the work goes on.
And speaking of passion, Cotexa Clipping's Chris Lott explores the healthy and not-so-healthy love of books.
The bookworm might turn to bibliolatry, the worship of books, or even bibliomancy, divination using books.
I hope you'll stick around. Last week was supposed to see a big party at the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Rasmussen Library. The building turned 50 years old. We hear from two of the directors at the institution. Later in the program, Paul McCarthy discusses his long and distinguished career at the Rasmussen. But first, current director Karen Jensen and her staff face an unprecedented challenge in the library's history with the COVID-19 pandemic. But I began our conversation by asking about her first visit to the library as a girl.
You know, I probably can't put an age on it because I grew up in libraries. Both of my parents, especially my dad, was a heavy, heavy library user. So we were always at the library just all throughout my life.
And when did you decide maybe that was a career for you?
Actually, that came a lot later, and that I can put a date on because it was 30. I was 30 before I went away to get my master's degree in library science. I'd been working in Alaska as a seasonal in Denali National Park, and that was wonderful, but it wasn't a strong financial future. So I decided to get my master's down at University of Washington.
When did you join the Rasmussen Library?
I started at the Rasmussen Library right after I got my degree in the fall of 1996. It was a good place to start. I initially went to the public library to see if they had any work, and they didn't. And I went over to the Rasmussen, and I went to see the head of reference and handed her my resume. And 3 weeks later, she called and said they had a temporary position. So that's how I started.
Now, on your webpage celebrating the 50 years the Rasmussen has been serving the university and Fairbanks communities, that originally they wanted to house every book written about Alaska by Alaskans.
So, and that quote, everything by Alaskans or about Alaska by Alaskans, that's actually dates all the way back to President Charles Bonnell. That was a quote from him and his goal in building a library for the University of Alaska. And the Alaska and Polar Region specialty has really given us a focus for collections, and it's world-renowned. We have researchers coming from all over the world to use the unique materials that we have in our library. So it's really fun. It's an amazing collection. It's broad and deep.
How about collaboration? Since it's circumpolar, you must have strong working relationship with other libraries and with other research institutions.
That's very true. So first, there's the Polar Libraries Colloquy, which is a conference that happens every couple of years with all of the polar libraries. Scott Polar over in Britain, there's lots of other libraries as well that focus on the north, focus on the polar regions. And so there's that conference every couple of years, and we're part of that. We've hosted that one here in Fairbanks. And then there's certainly a lot of sharing just within the state of Alaska. So we are part of the Alaska Library Catalog. We joined that a couple years ago. And the Alaska Library Catalog, it's been a dream of Alaskan librarians for many, many years. And it finally got going a few years back thanks to the UAA library that really got the ball rolling. But it required cooperation from libraries all over the state. So I would say upwards of 90% of Alaska's libraries share a catalog. And all of the major libraries in the state are on that catalog. And it's fantastic because it gives access to resources all throughout Alaska for all of the other communities. So that's been a real step forward in resource sharing.
The Rasmussen has extensive archives. What kind of demands does that put on the building, and how has that been met over the years?
Our archives are part of the overall collection, and the archives are unique, special materials that don't exist anywhere else. So we will have the only copy of something like a mining prospectus from the 20s or something like that. Really interesting and unique content. And you can see representations of that all around town. So the Antique Auto Museum, actually one of the distilleries downtown, has now some photographs from our archives, historical photographs. So the information that we're collecting, it's not dry and dusty. It's really interesting and fascinating. And yes, we have to have a good amount of space to store all that. We have to catalog it. We preserve it. And then we have to try to make it available to the world, which is a challenge. It's a challenge to have enough staff, have enough server space. People ask, why is not everything digitized? It's very expensive. It certainly would be great to achieve that goal, but it's a very costly enterprise to do that. So really what's digitized is just a representative sampling of what's down in our archives. And then you asked about control conditions. So most of the items that we have are not in climate-controlled conditions. They're just in interior library space on shelves or in drawers. However, we do have a couple of chilled vaults that allow us to store photographs and videos and oral history materials, recordings that are on more fragile media. And so right now, the vaults that we have to do that are absolutely full. They are jam-packed. We're storing things in the aisles, on carts. So one of our goals for the future is to build a new refrigerated space and also some freezer space. We don't have freezer space right now, and some of the materials really need freezer space to prevent the decay and decline of that material. So those are goals we're working on, and of course, you know, we're using all the space that we can get. The baby boomers are going to start giving us, they have started giving us, all of their materials, film footage they've taken around the state, photographs they've taken. So as they start to clean out their closets and donate material, we're going to need more space. So yes, it's an ever-growing collection.
I'll bet. The university has seen some significant budget cuts. How have those impacted the library, and how do you plan when you have an uncertain fiscal future?
Really, it's a hard time right now, and I have an amazing staff, and that's bright light that I can point to, that they are just absolutely fantastic and committed. But yes, we've been seeing budget cuts at Rasmussen now for more than 5 years. Every year has been a cut. And everything that's been cut has been were resources that were needed by someone. So essential personnel who performed certain functions, valuable subscription resources. You know, there's no extra. And any additional cuts are cuts that cause us to provide fewer services. So I feel like the university is the jewel and the crown of Alaska. And it's hard to see it being undervalued. I think people may not realize what they've got there, and we've got something really, really wonderful. So I try to take the long view. 100 years ago, there was a university, and 100 years from now, there's going to be a university, and I don't know what that's going to look like, but I can only see the value of higher education growing, and I think libraries are going to be a vital part of that. And, you know, our primary focus is ensuring that students do well and succeed. And any cuts do make it harder to fulfill that mission. So we're doing our best right now.
And also you're facing COVID-19 and the pandemic is unprecedented as well. How has that impacted your service?
Yes, that has definitely impacted. You know, we were busy planning for our 50th anniversary of the Rasmussen Library building, which was supposed to happen just a couple of days ago. And we were all planning for a nice big party that was going to be happening. And of course, the brakes got put on in mid-March. And what we're doing now is we've developed a system where one staff person can work at a time and retrieve materials or equipment for people. And then people can pick them up by appointment 24 hours later. So it's working pretty well. It's certainly not ideal. I think the library is a location. It's a place where people want to gather. Students want to study together. It's just not a storage facility. It's a hub of activity. And so it's been really hard seeing it just so quiet. But we are still providing those services. We're doing interlibrary loan. So the work goes on.
Well, finally, I got an interview not long ago, a couple of years back, with Paul McCarthy. Did you ever have a chance to work with him?
I absolutely did. I worked with Paul McCarthy. I was actually working in the circulation department as the supervisor when he returned to be our library director for the second time in his life. And he was a great presence in the library. And even when there was sort of drama going on or problems happening, he was always calm and supportive. So super encouraging since I've taken over this position as library director. And he has some great lessons to teach about managing people, because despite budget cuts are challenging. People are always the most important part of the enterprise. So I feel really, really blessed that I have a fantastic staff. And I know that I can call on Paul if I have questions. And he was one of the founders of our archives. So he had that long vision of where we wanted to go and what we wanted to become. And that's all happened. So he's fantastic.
Well, Karen Jensen, Director of Libraries at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, thanks so much for talking with me.
Yes, thank you.
Links to the Rasmussen Library's 50th anniversary page are on the Northern Soundings and KUAC websites. Following the break, we'll hear from longtime leader at the library, Paul McCarthy. This is Northern Soundings, and I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Welcome back. Several years ago, I had the privilege of talking with Paul McCarthy as part of UAF Summer Session series Down Memory Lane. Paul joined the library in 1964, before the Rasmussen was built, and he eventually helmed it. But he also spearheaded the formation of what has become a premier archive collection. He also worked in the private sector as a CEO. All of which is to say he's enjoyed a long and distinguished career. When we spoke 2 years ago, I asked how a former seminarian became a librarian.
I initially started off as a chemistry physics major. I don't know if I crashed and burned, but I certainly was ill-prepared to do that in college because I had gone to the seminary when I was in high school. So there was a rigorous curriculum in the seminary, but it in no way prepared you for science and technology. So it was a good background, great education. So I did turn to something I really enjoyed, history, and with another major in English and a minor in philosophy.
But library science.
Okay, the only library science on a baccalaureate level was really school librarianship. The librarianship was viewed as a graduate program once you had a technical or an expertise in a particular subject area or a broader subject area. It's a funny story. I'm nearing my degree finish, and I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I'm not sure I want to teach. So I went to Rochester Institute of Technology that had kind of vocational testing in that, and did all of that. And then they came back, and then in the interview said they, well, I matched up with two groups, priests and ministers or librarians. And I thought, well, I already tried the first, so I'm not going to do that, right? So I tried for the second, and it was a great choice.
So you graduate. How did you get from the East Coast to Fairbanks?
Well, I have to back up just a little bit. I worked full-time when I was going to graduate school. The second year, I applied for a position in the University Archives, which was the best decision I ever made. It got me into the Syracuse University Archives. It was a really great place to learn, and I got a chance to not only understand how to process collections, but I got a chance to go out and be excited about getting a piece of history or a part of collection of records that would document something that got pretty exciting when you get into it. And I had a chance to talk with Lowell Thomas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was an aggressive program, probably more aggressive than it should have been. They would send out 50 or 75 letters a week, and they would research, and they would look at people, check them out, da-da-da. and they would essentially solicit collections from them. So it was a double-barreled shotgun approach. And when I met Lowell Thomas, I had been really intrigued by him because when I was much younger, I'd listened to his weekly program, and one of the programs was broadcast from Tibet and Lhasa, and he called it being on the top of the world. And it was a closed country for many years until the threat of the Chinese invasion, and the Dalai Lama wanted to invite in people that would be able to see and enjoy and understand the country in the hopes that that would prevent the Chinese from coming in. So I always had this in my mind that I wanted to go to Tibet, and I did like 50 years later, 40 years later.
Just a little detour.
Right. So, but the associate director at Syracuse, who had hired me in the first place, took the position as director of libraries here when they wanted to revamp how they did libraries and what they did in a new approach and a more assertive or aggressive approach to libraries. And he asked me kind of flippantly if I'd ever consider coming to Alaska. And I said, sure, anything for a few years. And so the next year he offered me a position in the reader services area because he had a vacancy, but he said he wanted to start the archives in 65. And so he was able to secure the money and we started.
Let's go then to archives. What do we mean by archives, and what are the challenges of bringing in material, correctly documenting it, and then preserving it?
Well, to get back just a little bit, the term, official term for archives is usually corporate or some legal entity, their records. And so we called it archives versus manuscript collections. So a manuscript collection would be your personal papers or something else less than an official archive for a university. Because in that sense, provenance is really important to prove that you've had custody of those records, that they document what you say they document and represent your operations. So there was both of those that we started. With the manuscript collection, we started contacting like pioneers and some other people. And, you know, as you go along, the tree gets larger because people understand what you're doing and you get contacts and that. But before or at the simultaneously, we had to go through the collection that Otto Geist got together. Well, his collection was a warehouse probably 20 to 25 feet wide.
Wow.
About 20 to 30 feet long, and it was on the hillside. And some of you are old enough to remember that we used to have three or four sheds going down the hill on the left-hand side across from forestry. And so initially we opened the doors and it was like 8 feet high. It was 8 feet high. You know, you start going through it and sometimes you just got up on top and you crawled through and you kind of dipped down and got stuff. But there was some fantastic stuff there. I think the Alaska Commercial Company records were there that had been transferred to the university, some early records. And he saved everything. You know, he got a solicitation from Time, he saved it. He had his appendix taken out, he saved that.
And saved the appendix?
Right. He scared the hell out of one of our assistants. She opens this thing and she finds this specimen there. And she tried to figure out what it was all about, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And when we started the archives, we went through some of the utilidors. People now at the university don't realize that these utilidors were used for student traffic and storage and stuff like that. And occasionally students still try to get through them, but I think they've barred off most of them. But they used to be, you could go from Bunnell Building to any building on lower campus. Because there were records there. I mean, it was a warm place to store records, and if you're short of space, you utilize utilidors.
Okay, now that raises a really interesting point, because I know some of this material that you must acquire for the archives are fragile or can be damaged if the air is too humid or too dry or there's too much heat or whatever. So how do you coordinate which items need to be treated delicately and which could be more robust and go into those
Utilidors.
That wasn't a preservation choice
at all.
Oh, okay,
that was, I see.
No, no, it wasn't. They were just storing it. We were bulging at the seams, and so was the library. The library was, at that point, it was in the Bunnell Building, the east, the west side of the Bunnell Building on three floors. So you'd come in on the main floor and there would be books, and upstairs was the government documents and periodicals, I believe, were downstairs, and some current materials were there. And the famous lady named Lou was the painting that was visited often by tourists.
Well, when was the library's current home really finalized?
There was a big bond vote in 1966 to essentially bond for the library, the Fine Arts Center, and the theaters. That successfully passed. So they began building the library, and shortly after, I think in June of that year, or June of 1967, and it took about 2 years.
Well, that raises a question. When you go to construct a library, obviously books are heavy, there must be special designs you want built in.
Yeah.
What are some key elements you hope are built in? Do librarians have a say in how it's designed, or?
Well, there's architectural standards because floor load is a really, really critical area for shelving. I think it's like 175 pounds per square foot. And you want to build that into the building as much as possible to give you the flexibility that you can move materials around. So that would be part of it. Ventilation is certainly another part, but that's more standard. But there are certain, there's in fact a whole book on standards for building libraries.
Mm. Well, we'll maybe get back to buildings, but when you were tapped to be the head of the Polar Collection, that is a period of time when there was greater awareness to this collection and it was more integrated across the circumpolar. Would that be right?
It was beginning to be.
Talk about that growth.
We started the archives and we had a rare book curator, and we started a service in indexing every current periodical for Alaska articles, the Alaska bibliography. We started oral history a little bit later because Bill had started it as a special part.
Bill Schneider.
Bill Schneider, right. And then we added audiovisual. Dirk Tordoff did film archives.
Mm-hmm.
So that all started coming together. And I think a lot of skilled professionals who were really good in their field, Marvin, Bill, others, brought to the department an expertise. And I think going back to the director of libraries, Ted Ryberg, he instilled in me a real commitment to have a professional role, a role in the professional community. And so I've encouraged that, and they have done that. And that's kind of spreads the name of the university, of the Rasmussen Library, of the kinds of holdings you have. And grant writing, I think Marvin and I and Bill and several people have written grants to produce either finding aids or share collections outside of the university so that your reputation grows that way. And Ted Ryberg was one of the initial founders of the Polar Libraries Colloquy, and that gathered together people from both that studied the Antarctic and the Arctic in terms of a community. And so I think the reputation of the Rasmussen Library spread, and Dr. Wood humorously said, well, when he went to Europe, he would talk about the University of Alaska, and people didn't know very much about the University of Alaska, and then he would mention the Rasmussen Library, and they'd say, oh, we know where that is! You know, so the library had, I mean, people were really active, and there were lots of communications and sharing of material, so.
So let me ask you, you've risen through the ranks of the university, and leadership is an important skill. Was there a model you had of how to be a good administrator, how to be effective in that role?
I think many things that I had done earlier contributed to that. I had become very active in the Society of American Archivists, both on their council and treasurer, and had to explain things to other people, and particularly as their treasurer, that they did not want to hear. You know, like, we have to raise the dues. You know, we haven't raised the dues in a while, and this is why. And trying to communicate honestly I think integrity is a critical part of management. If you don't have integrity, you got nothing. I think respect. Everybody has untapped talents. They have lots of professional expertise or more limited, but they have a lot of talent. So I think part of my challenge as a manager or a leader is to provide an environment where people can really excel and support them with the logistics and the moral support, travel, whatever they need to develop a program. If it's important to them and it's important to us, we can really encourage that. And I think dealing with junior faculty, that's what you have to do, is you want to say, gee, you have a chance to really sparkle here at the university. In fact, that's one of the major things I have really valued about this experience is that nobody in Alaska, at least when I have been active, would say, oh, we don't do it that way here. Or, no, you can't do that. Or, why would you, you shouldn't, you know, just do this, you know. So we had a chance to initiate a lot of program, you know, if you get this financial support and justify it and go for it, you know, if it has some real contribution to the university's missions. And I think you gotta like people. You gotta like, I mean, it seems really strange, but a lot of people don't like people. And really, to respect them, to recognize that you're there to help them. You're not there as some autocratic boss.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment with Paul McCarthy, former director of libraries at UAF. When we return from the break, how to cope with tough times. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment with former UAF Director of Libraries Paul McCarthy. Let's return to the conversation.
When you're collaborating with international agencies, is there a standardized system that you cross-reference material from one country to another?
Well, I think the U.S. was a leader in really transforming libraries in terms of using computing technology to locate materials and to make them accessible and to get them from one place to the other quickly. There were two or three bibliographic utilities that provided support for libraries' effort. One was OCLC and one was WLM, where I had worked in the 90s. And they would provide this networked information. So there were standards established by the Library of Congress in conjunction with reputable, outstanding other non-governmental librarians. So yes, there's a standard, and it's really important that there was a standard, because then you can adapt that to the computer age pretty easily. Libraries were using computers in, I think, mid to late 70s. We had terminals in the library by 76 or 77 with the Western Library Network.
Well, let's go to that, because during your term as head of libraries, the computer age is coming on, card files are out, and terminals are in. Talk about that transition a little bit, and how easy is it to find software that's both user-friendly for the patron and the researcher, and user-friendly for the librarian or administrator?
Sometimes they're not the same software. You know, the library as an industry is huge. I mean, you've got university libraries, you've got public libraries, you've got special libraries, you've got community libraries. So it's a big market for companies. So there were probably 8 to 12 companies that were providing software choices for these. And it would be a gruesome and tough protracted contract negotiation and identification of your requirements to get into any one of these systems. We picked one from West Virginia, Virginia Tech, and it was a good system for when we adopted it. It didn't have stuff for special collections necessarily, but it did have for the libraries. This was not an instant switchover. The university tried that once in financial systems in 77. We had five presidents that were touched by that crisis. I mean, it was like a disaster. So we ran essentially parallel systems. You still had the card catalog, but you terminated the card catalog at a certain date. And then you started the computer catalog. But we ran the computer catalog for a couple of years before we unveiled it to the public, both to test it and to get some basic communal body of information in there. So we would run that, and there would be times when it would act strangely. One of our problems with the vendor was the contractor's written in such a way that it made expanding it really expensive. And so we had to redo the contract because I think the previous people who had negotiated it and implemented it from outside the library had not followed the letter of the contract and had expanded it. So we had to explain to the company why we should not pay for Kotzebue and Nome and the others the same fee that they would charge Syracuse University for the music library. I mean, they're like, okay, there's three people out there, very small collection. What they're doing is accessing our collection. So that's one of the challenges.
Yeah, I'm sure. Was it difficult for you and your colleagues as the computers came on, or was it really a boon and it opened up new opportunities?
It was exciting enough that there was a lot of encouragement to do it. It really transformed libraries incredibly. I was talking about how you catalog and all these cards, and you'd file hundreds or thousands of cards a week, and you were buying these expensive units. I mean, those things were like $600 or $800 a piece. You know, when we sold them off, it was a real bargain if you had a use for a card catalog at home.
Not a big draw for that, I'm guessing.
The oak was worth more than anything else. So we were the first department in the library to bring computers in. We brought them in I think, 1981 or something like that. We had a grant from the state legislature to arrange and describe Mike Gravel's papers. And we made the commitment to do this. In fact, we had been in a national trial when we were using punch cards in the late 60s. We had participated with the Library of Congress and National Archives and one or two other national institutions. And I thought that was a great thing for us to do. It put our name on the map, at least. So we realized what the incentive could be, what the promise could be, and it's just amazing. I mean, you realize now that you can access stuff from almost all over the world, certainly all over the United States and Canada. You can get information, and it's only a revolution that continued. Like in the 90s, there was another financial crisis, so we made I think this is pivotal, we made the decision really to start going completely computer access to periodicals. We were carrying, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 periodicals at the time at a massive cost of money. And they were inflating about 12% a year, way out of sync with everything else. And so we had the opportunity to start to buy individual titles and collections. And that has evolved so that now libraries connect and buy baskets of periodicals together. It's a funny way. Publishers are interested in selling as many copies of as many publications as they handle, right?
Sure.
Well, some of them are of niche interest, but they figure out that they can sell you this entire basket at a substantial discount and throw in all these other titles. And so it's really an attractive purchase for you. And if you do it in a combined of libraries, you get a much better price. And so we thought we could offer 100,000 subscriptions for less than it was costing us for 4,000.
That's quite a jump. Well, you were director, of course, during the economic downturn in the late 80s.
Scary time.
Scary time. Yeah. Well, today isn't so
great
either. But let's talk about, as a leader, as an administrator, how do libraries weather those times when dollars dry up? What are some of the strategies you and your colleagues come up with?
It's a really difficult. In the mid-80s, it was sudden, and the reductions were implemented very quickly. Many of the units, including the library, had no control over what was reduced. And the library had just staffed up like the year before. Mm. We brought in people specializing in instructional development, people who could sit down with instructors and help them get into the computer age, get into the audiovisual age, and make their collections more multimedia. Mm. That was all gone within a year. I mean, we hardly got the people up here when this happened. And we lost some other things. We had just finished the building. We had a brand new, really good studio that went empty. We could hardly equip it. In fact, there were two studios like that. And part of that reduction was, the scary part was that we only had like an hour or so to notify staff that their names were on the list, because they were going to release a report, and I believe we got the report like an hour or two ahead of time, and some people were traveling. And you had to say, hey, Hank, I have some bad news. You know, you're on the list. It doesn't mean you're going to be terminated, but you're on the list. I think terribly, terribly destructive. So, I mean, I think you have to look at primary missions. We have to think creatively. One thing that we did in the 90s when we were everybody was supposed to say how they would reduce 5, 10, 15, and 20%. And rather than fighting it, the staff members who might be really affected by it, more likely to be affected by it, jumped in and really helped. And what we did is we did a diagram of the building, a side section of it, and we'd say, okay, 5%, we strike out this and this. 10%, you strike this out. And 15%, you eliminate this floor. And at 20%, you get a new director, because you don't need somebody who can direct a bigger program anymore. So we did the best presentation.
Well, I'll bet you did.
And it was staff. And, the most important employment decision is who you hire. We have had great people in APR.
Well, I've talked to several people who've been on committees with you, and they all just praise your abilities to work in a team and contribute. And when you moved up the ladder again and became director of information technology, or when you were a provost, talk about integrating the library in the wider university community. And then you've mentioned this before, you have to be part of consortiums. When you buy these, let's say, magazine subscriptions, you have to be part of a larger team in that regard.
I always thought that library faculty should participate in the university and university committees, and I cut my teeth on faculty council and several others, and I worked on tenure and promotion committee, and I chaired the tenure and promotion committee. I felt that we had to do that because we wanted to make sure that people realized that we were a legitimate part of the academy, and we had a contribution to make. And I think you talk about the value of the library, how it's doing, what it's able to provide, and you're being really aggressive on providing services. You know, that's why we could provide services to faculty without ever coming to the library, which is a real plus, but the minus is then you don't want them to be disconnected from where the stuff comes. Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about it's all free on the internet. Well, it's not all free on the internet. The really good stuff that takes money to produce, unless it's National Geographic, is not free on the internet, you know. So I think explaining what it is, participating, and with the organizations, that's usually a function of the acquisitions person, and they put a lot of time into working with other organizations. And it could be like the Pacific Northwest, it could be Mountain States, it could be biological libraries. So it cuts geographically and subject-wise. So library might have been a member of 4, 5, 8, 10 consortia. Mm.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to my conversation with Paul McCarthy, former director of libraries at UAF. When we return from the break, an award-winning photographer.
Thank you.
talking this segment with Paul McCarthy, former director of the Rasmussen Library. The library is observing its 50th anniversary this year. Many people know of Paul's work as a leader at UAF, but many may not know he's an avid and much appreciated volunteer photographer for some of the school's sports teams. His work, though, as a photographer, was recognized earlier this year when he received the William R. Cashin Service Award. Let's return to our conversation.
In the 90s, you explored the private sector and became a CEO. And you've mentioned it's a huge industry. And what does library science look like in the private sector?
Well, WLN had been, as well as OCL, had been a pioneer in developing bibliographic utilities, essentially a database of all of these citations and titles and less of the text, but that was coming later. And the model WLN used was library by library. The model at OCLC was state by state. So they were a little bit of, to a great deal ahead of OCLC. But in WLN, what they did was really go to the library and work with the library to get dedicated lines. This was early in the 70s, so there weren't really big computer centers. There was nobody else really that much interested in the internet. So libraries were kind of going it alone. So WLN, all of the Pacific Northwest libraries were tied to WLN because of the dedicated cables. In the 90s, that started changing because it's like right now, if you want to buy some product, and you can buy it downtown, but you can't get it till next week when you go downtown, and you can get it after tomorrow if you order it through Amazon, they started shopping around. The first utilities so changed the industry initially that all of the people that founded those utilities, including there's a research libraries group too, were so profoundly committed and so existentially rewarded that they became almost religious adherents. I mean, it was like
so that seminary training came in handy, didn't it? There.
I mean, it was for the older people. It had made such a dramatic change, all to the good, that they were absolutely committed to it. Younger people coming up and with some of the financial pressures didn't have that same emotional connection. So they started looking around and some tried to do it on the cheap by essentially borrowing data from other sites by screen captures or stuff like that. So yeah. We had to change. The bibliographic utilities have then also provided access to these baskets of periodicals too. And when I was there, I realized that at one point that we were really too small for the internet economy as it was evolving, so we had to either bulk up or sell. And I had never done negotiating for mergers and that, but it's a steep but quick learning curve.
Learning curve.
So we tried to buy a couple of companies and they didn't. They tried to buy us and that didn't work. And then we went to Canada and we're going to buy a Canadian company. And we made an offer. We really did a careful cost analysis of what we thought it was worth to us. And we made what we thought is a reasonable offer. The company that we're going to buy that didn't work out, they made this outrageous offer. And we said, how can they do that? How can they do that? Well, in the due diligence process, they gradually lowered their bid till they were like $25,000 above ours. And this is like hundreds of thousands that they came down. So we didn't realize that part of it is, I don't want to say bluff and whatever it is. So at some point we realized that we really needed to negotiate with our arch competitor. And so their board was doing a total review of their mission and they wanted new blood from outside of the. So I called once he was appointed, but before he went, I called him up and just left a message that we're your competitor, but we could be an ally and love to talk to him when he would get to OCLC. Well, he called me up I went to lunch and he already had called me, and so we talked for about 2 hours, and then we made an appointment to meet secretly in St. Louis, way away from our home and their home.
Did you have to wear a disguise or anything?
No, it was really funny, and we could not talk about it. You could not share it with anybody because it would damage us and it would damage them. Mm. And if it damaged us and we thought that they did it maliciously, we could sue them, mm. and they knew that. And then we had another meeting in August, and then we went through due diligence on the weekend in October, and then announced it in a meeting in the week.
Wow.
It was an incredible surprise to everybody,
yeah.
even some of our own company.
Well, obviously a success. How did that, when you returned to the university, inform your work then moving forward? Because at that point, you're overseeing not only libraries, but technology and whatnot. How did that change things for you, Paul? And how do you position the school for the future? Maybe that's the question.
One of the shocks to me, I was on the board at WLN. We knew that the CEO was in trouble. So the three of us made an effort to interview staff, and it did not go well. It really did not go well. Mm. And so we met Monday, full board, and we asked for his resignation, and he was gone by the end of the week. They said, "Paul, we want you to do this." And I'm saying, "Hey, I live 1,500 miles from here." They said, "No, we'll work it out." And time is money made an impression on me because I said, "Well, I have trouble getting to, we're going to break to staff that Saturday that he was leaving." And this was like Monday. And I said, "I have to be in D.C. this next couple of days." And said, "Great." And I said, "And I have to be there next month or next week." And they said, "Okay, you fly back Thursday night, you work Friday and Saturday, and you fly back to D.C. And I'm going, "This is crazy. This is crazy." You know, but if you got to do something, you got to get the resources to do it right or change the parameters. And I think that informed some of my thoughts in terms of decision making. We have to take a more analytical approach and balance out value and cost.
Well, these last two questions, again, follow up on that in the sense that we're in another point of financial downturn at this point. How does the library hunker down? And more broadly speaking, how do you convince lawmakers of the value, not just of higher education, but the critical role libraries play in servicing not only the academy, but the public in general in an open society? How do you do that?
It's a tough time to be trying to attract people to the University of Alaska.
That's right.
I mean, if you're a young professional or a middle-seasoned professional, you might think, "Gee, I've heard all this bad press about the university. Why would I go there on a gamble?" So I think we have to overcome that. I think we have to really stress that there is a tremendous opportunity at the university. I mean, and I think we're dampened by this crisis, but I think we're going to come through it. I think part of it, the advantage that we had is that all of us were persistent grant writers. So a good deal of the department in the 80s and 90s was soft money. But we had a number go through. Like I had ended up with 8 grants as an emeritus. I took one with me, but we did a lot of work in the Russian Far East. Mm. We had 11 trips to Russia, and we did work with their scientific staff and their information people in Magadan, Khabarovsk, and Yakutsk. But I think part of it is personal contact. I think in Alaska, personal contact is really, really important.
Even to lawmakers, for example?
Especially to lawmakers.
Especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to try to rationalize it. We didn't talk about why history is important, and I think the reason that it's so exciting to be working in the archives and work in this area is, one, it gives you roots in terms of who you are and who you are as an Alaskan. It gives you a perspective of what it is like to be in Alaska, because we all haven't been here all of our lives, and even those of us who are younger and have been need to know what went on before us. I think for me, one of the most alarming things was in the mid-80s, I think it was, or late 70s, when they were studying the population of Alaska, they said the average resident of Alaska has been here for less than 5 years. And you're thinking, whoa, wait a second. When we all leave home, you see what our family's style of living, and we think, well, we'll just slip right into that, not knowing that, like with my mom and dad, and I did an interview with my dad, which was incredibly revealing to me, is how poor they were when they started out, and you know what they had to go through: Second World War, separation, da da da, and you know, and we need to know that about what happened in Alaska in 1990 and 1950 and 1900 and 1800. I mean, when you see Native people on the street, you have to appreciate that they came here 10,000 years ago. Their forebears came here, and they're still part of our culture, even though we've almost overwhelmed them. That it's an important part. So I think we have to, and that's why I think Bill's work with Native people is critical, and we have to involve all of our population. We have to bring history to people again, its importance.
You have a great many hobbies, but you're a terrific photographer. How did you get into photography, and has that always been a passion of yours?
Well, you know, a good friend of ours, a priest, a Capuchin monk, says, you know, you live life forward, but understand it backward. Huh. I was brought up in Rochester, didn't put this together right away. I had two uncles that worked for Kodak. I had a mother that worked in the industry during the World War II, and in Rochester, cameras were often and many. I mean, it wasn't anything.
Passed them out like candy, did you?
Well, my mom had a movie camera. My uncle had a movie camera. They had still cameras, and, you know. So it was just part of what you might be, you know. And so I came up here. I had a camera, and then I came up here, and there was a little project that Lou Rowinsky in the museum wanted me to work on. So I did that, and I bought a camera, and then pretty soon I bought another camera, and then I just used it for a lot of personal and professional purposes. We did some ultraviolet-like photography on manuscripts and that kind of thing. And then when I came back in 2002, I really wanted to look at this digital thing. So I visited with my son in California, and we went to the local store, and they were just cleaned out. There was nothing there. It was Christmas, you know. He said, well, let's go down to Sammy's camera. And he said, I always wanted to go there. And so we went there like the Friday after Christmas, which was still a crazy time to go, you know. We got in there early, and it was like the ultimate candy store. I mean, we had a hard time finding it. We looked around, and we couldn't see the address. And finally, we did the loop around, and we looked up, and we saw this three-story camera on the side of a building. And the reason, they had nothing on the storefront. You know, on the main street, there was nothing. That was the clue. So I got into digital, which was fun, because I used to have a darkroom, but only a black and white darkroom. I didn't mess with color because it was too troublesome. And so I thought, wow, this way you can take the picture and control the results, and you don't have to send it out. So I started that, and then I thought, well, nobody's taking pictures of hockey. And so I took a couple pictures of hockey, and Guy Gadowski, who was a coach, said, gee, nobody's taking pictures now. So I thought, well, I'll do that. And then I got another camera, and then I started taking basketball pictures, and I got another camera, and then it's a spiral down, you know. Sven can, you know, it's like an obsession, a healthy obsession.
Well, Paul McCarthy, what a joy to talk with you.
Well, thank you
so much.
Okay, absolutely.
When we return from the break, Chris Lott discusses the sometimes questionable and forbidden love of books. Here's Chris Lott and Catexa Clippings.
Readers love to talk about books. In fact, if my life is any indicator, people like to talk about many more books than they've actually read. Besides being a time-honored school tradition, I sometimes think I've earned multiple degrees in faking my way through discussions about books I've mostly, quote-unquote, read. This is also just a fact of life for the book's beloveds. The book lover's heart wants what it wants. The Japanese have conveniently come up with a term for this unrequited love, sundoku, a slang term that literally means to let books pile up unread. Even better for word nerds, Sundoku is based on a pun. Sundeoku means piling something up. Some clever person thought to replace the oku with doku, which means to read, and over time, Sundeoku collapsed to Sundoku, the kindest word I know to describe my own accumulation affliction. Which isn't to say English doesn't have an overflowing stock of words about books, and as the tech bros might say, words that are book adjacent. The biblio words alone, biblio is a root from the Greek biblion, meaning paper or scroll, could be the subject of a monograph if they aren't already, going well beyond the familiar bibliography. A bibliophile is a lover of books. When that love is carried to extremes, they could be called a bibliophage, or one who devours books. This devouring is usually metaphorical. Sir Francis Bacon had advice that 300 years later remains wise, when he wrote that some books should be tasted, some devoured, but only a few should be chewed and digested thoroughly. But occasionally the bibliophagist acts literally, as in the case of legendary guitarist Mike Bloomfield, who is said to occasionally tear out and eat a particularly tasty page. An extreme bibliophile might also become a bibliomaniac, a similar condition, but one which William Walsh observed differs from the bibliophile because the latter has not yet freed himself from the idea that books are meant to be read. Sometimes merely possessing a book, and even reading it, which at its best is being possessed by the book, isn't enough, at which point the bookworm might turn to bibliolatry, the worship of books, or even bibliomancy, divination using books. The Bible is a common source text for Christian bibliomancers, known colloquially as Bible crackers. But countless texts have been used over the years, including religious texts of all kinds, Greek epics, the works of Shakespeare, and in the future when I commit to answering my constant self-questioning, the CIA's recently declassified counterintelligence interrogation manual. This wordy soothsaying might seem far-fetched, but as a general approach, I prefer it to those involving piles of entrails. Unless the process involves destroying the books, then I could go either way. Bibliophokes' book-seeking eyes are often larger than their wallets. For some of us, that means keeping long lists of someday books and occasionally pining through the glass at handsomely bound editions we can't afford. For some others, this unrequited love leads to larceny, transforming the bibliophile to a biblioclept, a stealer of books, who at home is likely a bibliotaph, one who hoards, hides, and locks away those books, the kind of accumulator for whom this word's dark roots, the Greek taphos, meaning burial or tomb, also gives us epitaph, are a better fit than the playful Sundoku. Giving books away is a good way to rein in one's bibliotaphic tendencies. I like to stuff books into the numerous little free libraries in my neighborhood, preferable to becoming a self-hating, or worse, generally book-hating, biblioclast or destroyer of books. The biblioclast destruction, their biblioclasms, most often by burning, are not a good look. I say, and maybe this should be my next and only tattoo, bibliogasms, not biblioclasms. This puts me in good company with Gustave Flaubert, who wrote that the one way of tolerating existence is to lose oneself in literature as in a perpetual orgy. That would be a high enough note to end on, but one more thing in honor of UAF Rasmussen Library's 50th anniversary this week. I didn't realize during my time working there, way back when I was young and my own heart was an open book, that the library was almost exactly my age. Back then it seemed to me a grand, already enduring institution. Everything there seemed wondrous and I was sure filled with wisdom, from the obvious, the seemingly incalculable number of books, to the more subtle, like the cranky elder poet, all of 23, who changed my life by thrusting a few books of poetry my way in the nicotine-stained smoking lounge, which really was a thing. Perhaps it's time then to revive a 400-year-old title for librarians and rebrand them as bibliothecaries, stewards of books, it's true, but much more too, the heady, vital provisions and remedies of intellectual life. For more bookish words, or to listen to any other cachexic word segments your book-loving heart desires, including musings on anthropodermic bibliopagy, library lingo, or a deep dive into the colophon, head on over to cachexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this show. I'm your host, Robert Hannon, wishing you health and safety. Thanks for listening.